All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, Nicks? What the fuck, buddies? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's it going? Are you ready? Are you packed? Are you heading out today, tomorrow, Saturday? Are you already there? Is it coming down on you? The weight of the festivities, the glorious and exciting, uplifting weight of the festivities with family. How's the tree? Is the tree nice? Did you get a good tree? Did you decorate it good? Did you get some new ornaments? What's happening? Sorry, I'm trying to engage with my non-Jewish friends who are doing the Christmas. Are those for the Christmas? That's an amazing scene in the film Boogie Nights. Oh, are those for the Christmas? Don Cheadle with arguably the best line in the movie. Oh, are those for the Christmas? Before blood splatters everywhere. Merry Christmas to you. Today I talked to Blitz Bazawule. He's the director of the new movie musical version of The Color Purple, which I saw. He's a filmmaker and artist originally from Ghana, and he was also one of the directors on Beyoncé's musical film, Black is King. And I loved the movie. I love his movies, to be honest with you. But I'll get into that in a minute. Los Angeles, I'm at the Elysian Theater tomorrow, December 22nd. I'm at Dynasty Typewriter on Thursday, December 28th. And I'm at Largo on Tuesday, January 9th. Then I'm in San Diego at the Observatory North Park on Saturday, January 27th for two shows. San Francisco at the Castro Theater on Saturday, February 3rd. Portland, Maine, I'm at the State Theater on Thursday, March 7th. Medford, Massachusetts, outside Boston at the Chevalier Theater on Friday, March 8th. Providence, Rhode Island at the Strand Theater on Saturday, March 9th. Tarrytown, New York at the Tarrytown Music Hall on Sunday, March 10th. Atlanta, Georgia, I'm at the Buckhead Theater on Friday, March 22nd. And I'll be in Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. A radio legend passed away a couple of nights ago. Jim Ladd was one of the great radio personalities of the Los Angeles region. He also did an episode of this show. He was also on an episode of my show, Maron. The episode he did of WTF was episode 658 from November 2015. It's available in the free feed right now. Rest in peace, Jim Ladd. Radio was something. Radio was everything for a long time. I think I learned how to talk on these mics on radio. And you got to give respect to the legends of that medium. Jim Ladd, rest in peace, buddy. So listen, you guys, I wrote a joke. Yeah, I wrote a joke. I don't always write jokes. I kind of do bits. It was a pretty easy one to do. So I did it. I said on stage last night that Donald Trump used a line from Hitler. Yeah, he said that immigrants are destroying the blood of our country. Now, look, I know Donald Trump's a racist, and it's not the racism that bothers me. It's the plagiarism, people. I mean, if you're going to take someone's line, you got to either source it correctly or cite your reference or just have the courage to just give the author credit. I mean, you know, come on, Trump, just be like, you know, as Hitler said is a nice way. You could set it up like that. Or one of my heroes, Hitler, put it this way. It's just, don't be a coward, and plagiarism is bad. That was the gist of it. I thought it was pretty funny. So many of you people know that I have a latent thing or love for musicals. And the reason I say latent is because I don't really seek them out. But when I do experience them, they cause me to feel things. And I think in this conversation with Blitz, we kind of come upon the reality that I believe the reason that I cry almost immediately when any large group of people start singing, whether it's a musical, a choir, not so much a band, but just something about the vulnerability of musicals. I don't know, man. I think we figured out that I'm not great at generating joy from myself, from the inside. But when joy is thrust upon me, my body shudders and experiences emotions that I want to stop, but I know they're good and I stay with them. I don't really want them to stop, but for some reason I'm a little ashamed of them. I don't know. That's another journey. But that seems to be the thing that happens to me when it comes to musicals. And I've been thinking about it. I think I really wish that I was the type of entertainer that could do a little song and dance occasionally. I'm not talking about singing a rock song with my guitar and a band. I'm talking about like doing a little, you know, kind of a jaunty tune and maybe a, you know, kind of dancing around a little bit and, you know, spread my arms open like, ah! I like even that. Maybe I didn't. Maybe there's still an opportunity. Maybe I should work out a musical number from a musical with another performer and do the dance number that goes along with it. Maybe that should be on my bucket list. Maybe that's what I'm avoiding. Maybe I need to do that. Maybe that'll change my entire disposition around entertaining and having feelings and love and joy for the audience and just really giving people a nice, emotionally well-rounded good time. That's what I'm missing. That's what I need to do to, without irony, do a musical number or two from a musical with dance steps. But I'm putting that on the list. I'm putting that in my mind. I'm putting it out there to you that I will manifest it. I will. Now, look, talking to Blitz Bazawule, he hasn't made a lot of movies, so I was able to really kind of dig in, and I had some realizations, and these were not realizations that I haven't had in some form before. I watched a couple of his short films, and I watched his first feature, The Burial of Kojo, which he shot in Ghana, which is where he's from, which is where his brain developed, which is where his sense of poetry, mythology, storytelling, and color comes from. And I had this realization, which I've had before. I had it when I watched Reservation Dogs, that when you look at the world through the point of view of an artist from another place, another culture, a completely different visual sensibility because of that, you know, that's how you see or experience that culture. If you're not going to go there, I'm not going to go to Ghana. And I just had this kind of beautiful experience with Blitz's first movie, The Burial of Kojo, around the poetry, how he structures story, you know, how he sees composition and color. And it really is why, you know, movies are so important and why art is so important, again, is that it connects you with the humanity of the world, of others, of the point of view of others, the point of view of people that you think are different than you or come from a different place, something you'll never see and can't imagine if you won't travel there and kind of entrench yourself or engage yourself with a different culture on that culture's terms. But you can do it through a movie. And it was kind of mind-blowing to me to kind of put that together and then to move through his other work, to watch Black is King, the Beyoncé concept musical, I guess concept album musical, and then to watch The Color Purple, which I saw in New York at a friends and family screening, cast and crew, friends and family type of screening. It was spectacular because many people from the cast of this new film were there, and many people were in the audience from the several versions of the Broadway musical. Some of the original cast was there. It was very emotional for some of the cast of the film to meet their counterparts from the past. There was an amazing moment between Danielle Brooks, who plays Sophia, and the woman who originated on stage, who inspired Danielle to to pursue a life in theater. And we all witnessed that. And Fantasia Barrino, who was on stage with it, is also in the movie. She plays Celie. And it was just to be at that screening was kind of spectacular to see the emotional depth of the impact of that show on this new cast as humans and as performers was really something. There is a tradition to it almost, a history to it, a story that's been told several ways from the book, from Spielberg's film, from several versions on Broadway. And it's a story that's pretty dug in to Black culture in a way that that spans, you know, generations. So it was quite an experience to watch it that way. And I'll be honest with you, I loved it. I don't really necessarily know how to judge musicals, but I thought it was great. And after talking to Blitz and knowing where he comes from visually and intellectually and how he sourced the book more than anything else, it was kind of like a kind of a very personal and very unique vision for this new version of The Color Purple, and I appreciated it. I've been going to the cinema quite often. I went to the movie theater on the big screen to see Poor Things. That's the Yorgos Lanthimos, Emma Stone, Mark Ruffalo, you know, the Gerard Carmichael, many, many guests of mine. Rami Youssef was in it. Yeah. I'd like to, Willem Dafoe was in it. I've talked to all of them, and all of them were quite good. Willem did not like me. It doesn't matter. The film is amazing. It's quite a vision. And you expect that from Yorgos Lanthimos. You expect something surprising, brain-bending, over-the-top, a bit crazy, very surreal in parts. But this thing had a real heart to it and a real journey and a real transformation. And I think it's his best movie. And I think Emma Stone is fucking amazing. And Ruffalo was great. Was a great comic character. And I'll tell you, man, to see Poor Things on a giant screen down at AMC was fucking great. And I had forgotten what it was like to really experience movies. I mean, ever since Oppenheimer at the IMAX and Barbie as well, I was like, this is how it was. This is how we used to see movies when I was a kid. This is how big they should be. And it makes a difference. And there is something about going to the movies. It doesn't matter how many people are in the movies. There's something that happens to your focus. There's something that closes you in, that insulates you, that puts you in the box with the film. Not like checking your cake. Not like seeing if the pasta is ready. Not checking your phone. Not feeding your cat. Not pausing. That the fully immersive effect of going to the movies is still pretty fucking great. And it burrows into you, and it humanizes you, man. Beats you down with the wizardry of illusion. Can you dig it? Okay. Blitz Bazabwile is a filmmaker, a musician, also a novelist. The Color Purple opens in theaters everywhere on Christmas Day. I recommend it highly, and this is me in conversation with Blitz. I saw the movie, I saw The Color Purple at the screening in New York. I enjoyed it.
Oh, thanks.
And then I knew I was going to talk to you. So then I kind of like, you know, what do I know about West Africa?
Oh yeah.
And then I realized, like, all right, so here's what I do. I got records, you know, and I'm thinking, like, you know, when I was a kid, King Sonny a Day.
Yeah.
And then Baba Mal, those early Senegal
of
records,
course.
Right?
Great stuff.
Yeah, and then I realized, well, I got this Lagos 1970 funk juju collection.
Great era.
Right?
Great.
So I listened to that double record. Then I had some old Cora music, which was not necessarily relevant, but I did it.
Yeah.
And then somehow or another, I got, because I know you paint, I got, you know, I landed in my head that I was thinking of Basquiat's self-portrait with tie.
Oh, yes.
And then I looked at the Henry Taylor book.
Okay.
Because I just saw that.
Good ones.
And then, you know, and I watched your early film. So, you know, like, I had a, because when I was watching, not The Color Purple, but when I watched the Burial of Kodjo.
Yeah.
You know, you start to realize, or I do, that, you know, I have no visual sense of where you come from. And it's a completely different place. And, you know, you're from there, so your sensibility around it. So it's like going to another world.
Indeed. I mean, but that's the beauty of cinema, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of that ability to transport us, you know? And that for me, the craziest thing is it started for me in a soccer park in Ghana.
Yeah.
Because, okay, let me give a little context.
Yeah.
A coup happens in the 80s in Ghana. A lot of the cinema houses closed down, right?
Now, like, was that an autocrat? Was that a little...
Yeah. We went through a little window of dictatorship, you
okay.
know?
How long?
You know, it was like, I think, 82 to like 92.
So you're how old?
You know, I'm 40 now.
No, but how old were you then?
Oh, back then, geez, I was like, what, 82 to 92? Yeah, so like 10.
Right, so that's because I was wondering, because not knowing the history of Ghana... You know, the imagery that comes up in the Native Son, and the imagery that comes up in The Black is King, you know, and, you know, in terms of choices boys must make,
yes.
That's where it comes from.
Indeed.
Okay, so
and
soccer.
So it's that outdoor kind of soccer park.
Yeah.
But the wildest thing was no cinema houses, or not many of them, and so a lot of what we get are the evangelical movies. That are projected for
American
free.
Evangelical
yeah,
movie?
Yeah. It was big. And you know what? One they used to show all the time.
What?
The Last Temptation of Christ.
Well, that's
So I was getting Marty Scorsese.
I'm surprised that the evangelicals were behind that.
They were projecting that.
I thought they had a problem with that one.
Maybe not this specific. I mean, they were just showing as many Jesus movies as they could.
Right, yeah.
And of course, you know, this one was a big one.
So these were missionaries?
They were missionaries, yeah. You know, and they did them for free outdoors. But those were like the one of those like amazing things you looked forward to.
Yeah, right.
Because it was communal. You did your chores early. You got your mat, you took it to the park, you laid it out, you waited for the movie to start.
Yeah.
And the projection, right, of this world
yeah.
that you were like, I didn't know this world existed.
Transported.
I mean, down the line, you find out it's Martin Scorsese and he's done Taxi Driver, he's done,
right.
You know.
Sure.
You know, Goodfellas.
But at the moment, when you're 10, you just know, like, you know, I'm away.
That's it.
Right.
That's it. And that for me, I've never... forgotten that feeling. As a matter of fact, that scene in The Color Purple where Suge takes Celie to the movies, that's an homage. Mm-hmm. That was me watching and being transported and going, wow, the worlds that lie beyond infinite.
Yeah, and there's a couple of homages. There's that in Black is King, there's that Esther Williams kind of swimming.
Swimming, of course, of course, of course, of course.
Where did you find that thing?
Well, that was B. That was Beyonce.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we were constantly going back and forth. There were parts that I did in South Africa, like that levitation when a guy goes up.
Well, and also the theme of, you know, whether it's horses or motorcycles and masks and devils.
Yes.
That seems to be,
you know,
your
it's,
realm.
It's kind of, but all of it really, I'll tell you where all of it comes from. It's my grandmother's stories.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
So this is in Ghana, like what is the situation family-wise for you?
So my family's from the northernmost part of Ghana. We are like Sisala people, way up top, right?
And what's that border on?
So that border is on Burkina Faso.
Oh.
Right. So it's right, we're right, you know, my village is right underneath Burkina Faso.
Yeah.
But what happens is that everyone migrates to the south, which is Accra, for work.
And so that's where you grew up.
So I grew up in Accra.
What's the work?
You know, work, any work,
okay,
all work, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So my father and my mother moved down there, and so that's where we were all born. And then...
What was his work?
My dad at the time was a civil servant, you know, and my mom's a teacher. My mom's always been a teacher.
A civil servant for the government?
For the government.
For whatever government?
You know, I was, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, right? At the time. So, but what's exceptional is my grandmother comes to stay with us because she has asthma.
Yeah.
And that window is like my window into storytelling.
Right.
Because, you know, power was kind of like electricity was kind of in and out back then. And so whenever power go out, my grandmother's stories were the only thing that would keep us, you know.
And what were they mostly?
Man, they were folk tales, but they were like the movies I make today.
No, I know. I saw, like, because I was wondering where that comes from. I mean, I saw in both in Native Son and in also in, you know, The Burial of Kojo that, like, I didn't know if they were allegories because some of it's biblical, some of it's folk story. I mean, the Burial of Kojo is somebody telling a story.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's kind of, I've always... That's kind of been my de facto into storytelling, but also the possibility that story doesn't have to be linear, right? It could be cyclical.
I know.
Right?
And cyclical.
So, you know what I mean? And so that's kind of, for me, my grandmother's stories became like the basis. And I think everything I've done, music, you know.
So transitioning into the visual elements of nonlinear storytelling, because, you know, sometimes when I watch things, I'm like, what did I miss? And
yeah,
but in the way you describe it though, if it's nonlinear and it's cyclical, then you know it's more poetic.
Yes,
and the connections aren't as cut and dry.
No, that they're what's a good word? They are the way they connect are not overt. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think that for me has been an exciting thing. To participate in this particular medium because cinema is such a very Western, you know, style where most things are very, you know, three-act structure.
Yeah, sure.
I got to know what answers what.
Yeah.
You know, people have been telling all kinds of stories in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
Way before this medium. I mean, this medium's quite young.
So that's true. But so your grandmother, though, in terms of imagery, because it seems like some of the elements of the early movies, you know, have to do with symbolism that's not necessarily explained, but almost in a folktale story, child story kind of way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And again, I think that's like that's what for me excites me about the possibilities of this medium. And I always compare it to music, you know, music so free.
Sure.
I mean, it's every kind, no matter where you go. Indigenous people make, Western people make, Africans make it, Europeans make. It's just such an amalgam. And because the freedoms to create are, and specifically the African and the African diaspora, if you think about the freedoms that the musics have had, I mean, everything from gospel, jazz, blues, funk, R&B.
Yeah.
Afrobeat, Roomba, and some of the records we're talking about, the juju music, the high life, the Afrobeat, the freedoms that exist in those mediums are yet to be felt in cinema, I think.
Interesting.
I think. Yeah. Because the medium is so young that, you know, it's also quite narrow. Because of the barriers to entry, I mean, it's a very expensive medium.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's getting more and more. I mean, the reason I was able to make The Burial of Kojo is the advent of digital cameras.
Sure.
I could not dream about making that movie. First, I couldn't afford to make it.
Yeah.
But we took chances making that movie because it was fairly cheap to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that the more the medium gets decentralized and more people have access, I think we're going to see... It's going to be like music. It's going to be like poetry. It's going to be
poetry,
like...
Poetry, yeah. Like the music, because like even when you do like Black is King, which is essentially music, that, you know, what you have though, it's a little different. There's an intensity and a speed and like there are a lot of costumes.
Yes, lots of costumes. Lots.
I can't even imagine those shoots, the wardrobe truck. Yeah. There must have been four of them.
Tons. Yep.
But it all happens so quickly. So when you really translate a sense of rhythm that is similar to music to film, which I think you probably achieved a lot of in Black is King.
Absolutely.
That everything happens very quickly, so you know you don't sit with the imagery as long.
Yep.
But it all hits you, but it's a lot. It's overwhelming.
It is. It is. And I mean what but that was its intent, right? I think when you move into The Color Purple, now we can ballet a little bit more, right? So you can still take that same sense of visual poetry, but now you kind of now can live a little longer in these worlds.
But also the music's different.
Yes.
Right?
Very different.
Because even if you look at like the early ones, like I'm trying to look at the timeline here, but the diasporadical trilogia.
Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, this is essentially poetry that happens in three grooves.
Yes.
I guess.
Yes.
And the story is, you know, there are three different stories, you know, through the idea of somebody existing in three different worlds and times.
Yes. Yes.
But it's essentially a Black story about a woman. Yeah.
Yes.
So, but those are all different. So then you can see the different rhythms.
Absolutely.
Because you're dealing with different times, different countries.
Yes. Different time signatures.
Yes.
Right. Which I find, again, I love that film. And here's the amazing thing about cinema. It ends up being an amalgam of all of these kind of separate creative mediums. Like you got to be a poet to make a film. You got to know how to write. I mean, it's great. Cinema is great writing.
That writing and also a sense of frame and time.
Time, all that stuff. You have to know visual, you know, blocking and framing. That's another massive thing.
Yeah.
So photography becomes a thing that you have to, or painting, now, you know, and you have to know rhythm, music. You got to know how scenes are going to, I mean, I've seen directors like literally like conduct a scene,
yeah,
you know, and you go, wow, like this is rhythmic. So when you think about it, the better you are at all of these seemingly disparate mediums.
Well, not really. You mean painting, music, and film?
Yeah.
Poetry?
Yeah, poetry. Writing. All these things. They seem siloed, right?
But they're all in film.
In film, exactly. And that's what I love about the medium is that, wow, like I can read a thing. I can read a book and go, wow, I know how to, in a way, approximate that for a shot in my film.
Or even a feeling.
A feeling. Yeah. That's it.
So, well, what was the first thing for you? I mean, outside of seeing, you know, evangelical films outdoors, in the middle of a coup, where you need
it wasn't in the middle of a coup, but it was post coup,
but it's tense.
It's tense.
You know, things are a little destabilized.
Yeah.
A little nervous.
Absolutely.
You know, new people on horses and motorcycles.
That
I guess
stuff.
Different
that
uniforms.
Stuff. Absolutely.
But and you're a kid, so there's an escape to it. But what was, you know, who was kind of supporting your creativity? You had a bunch of siblings.
Yes, it was my mother.
Yeah.
My mother was, I mean, God
She's
bless.
She's a teacher.
She's a teacher. My mother let me be.
Yeah.
And I got to say this, you know, Ghanaian kid, there's a couple things you can be.
Yeah.
A banker, a pilot, respectable jobs.
Yeah.
Nobody respected art.
Yeah.
My mother made sure, and I was also living in a house that was constantly under construction. So there was always like some crevice that was free.
Uh-huh.
My mother would say, take that. It's yours.
Yeah.
That's where I learned to draw.
Yeah.
And I will say, every idea I've ever had creatively has come from a piece of art.
Mm.
Before I write a song, I have to sketch it out. I got to draw what I think I see.
Yeah.
You know, before I make a movie. I mean, I go overboard with that.
With storyboarding?
Oh, my goodness. I storyboarded over 1,500 frames of storyboard for The Color Purple.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. For Black is King, that's actually how I got the job.
From storyboards.
Yeah, yeah. Beyonce saw my storyboards and was like, give this kid a job now, you know? Burl of Koja was the same. But I value it because I really believe that if you and I got the same script, went off to shoot a movie, we'll come back with two completely different movies.
Sure.
Because we see the world completely different.
Yeah.
And if I showed you a piece of drawing and I said, we're shooting that.
Yeah.
Oh, we all gonna shoot that because we know where the camera goes.
Yeah.
Right. And so I've been very fastidious about that.
But it was not but that evolved. Like, you know, at the beginning, as a creative person, you know, what did you see yourself doing? You know, you learned how to draw.
That was it.
And then you were gonna what? Draw?
Just gonna draw. And then because I didn't know no better. I loved it. I could sit down for hours, yeah. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
People left me alone. My mom let me be.
Yeah.
But then came hip hop.
Hmm.
You know, and hip hop was.
How old were you?
Same time.
10?
You know, 10.
11?
Yeah.
19, how'd you hear it?
Well, Public Enemy came to Ghana.
Yeah. Oh, they came and performed.
They came to perform in Ghana.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chuck D and
did you
Flavor
go?
Flav. No, I was a kid. I couldn't go.
But
that's all they talked about on the radio. That's all they played on the radio was It Takes a Nation of Millions.
No one went in your family?
No one.
Yeah.
No one. But I mean, my neighbors went and they came back with war stories.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
And I was like, whatever that is. And they some people had T-shirts. That was the first time I'd seen the logo.
Do you, any of your siblings artists?
No, not really. I mean, my brother drew too, but he kind of like let it go. But I used to just copy his style.
Yeah,
as a kid.
So he showed you shit.
He showed me shit.
Yeah,
a lot of good shit too.
Yeah. Did he have records?
My brother was. I mean, he was the purveyor of hip hop.
Yeah.
So like, my brother came home.
Wait, you mean he sold it?
Sorry,
he sold hip hop records.
No, purveyor to you. To me. I mean, he introduced me to this incredible world. Because what it was he would go off to secondary school, which is what high school in America.
Right.
And that's when hip hop had broken.
Right.
And so, you know, tapes like Rakim, De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest, he brought home.
Right.
And like, he'll call me, like when he comes home after like a whole term at school, he'll call me to the back of the house.
This is what I got.
This is what I got. And I mean, I'll be enamored. I was like, what is this?
What was the music in the house previous to hip hop?
High Life.
It was High Life.
All about love.
Right, but that's where those horns come from.
Yeah, that's where it comes from. Absolutely. But I mean, again, at the time, I was just tired of it. I was like, that's all they play on the radio. That's all my parents like. You know, it's, same thing was happening here in America, right? It was like, here are all these R&B records.
Sure. And then all of a sudden,
it's hip-hop.
But the High Life music, was that out of Niger or where was it from?
Ghana.
It was all from Ghana.
All from Ghana. Yeah, we had some amazing. I mean, Abel Taylor, who's still active, was one of our biggest.
Yeah,
there was some phenomenal records. I mean, I'll send you a playlist. It's incredible.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that shifted your whole sensibility. You realized like there's something else happening.
Something else. And you know what I loved about hip hop?
Mm.
Audacity. Mm. You know, these
here, gave
these,
you confidence.
Confidence. Here are these guys who were counted out. Nobody had any plans for them.
Yeah.
And somehow they had captivated the world.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
Maybe if I can do that, I'll have a shot.
So you thought music now.
Now it's music. So now that same room, now I got my mom's banging on the door now.
Yeah.
Because it's no longer quiet.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's always, she called boom, boom, boom music.
Yeah,
this is all this boom, boom, boom.
Get your pencil.
You know what I mean? And but I loved it. I kind of got sucked into this, you know, vortex of
Did
like-
Did you start writing then?
Started writing.
Rap lyrics.
Rap lyrics. And you know how I did them? I just copied, you know, I don't know, like a De La Soul record, and I'll, you know, change a line here, change a line there.
Figure out the structure.
Change out the structure, throw my name in there, pretend I wrote it all.
Yeah.
You know, I was doing a lot of that.
Yeah, were you performing it?
Yeah, at school.
For your family? Oh, at school.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, people thought I was good. But it was all just like Biggie Smalls records.
Yeah.
I was faking.
Yeah, yeah.
Who the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Paging me a 546, send him this, da da da. And like, oh, he's good. No, it's just all Biggie.
But a lot of them didn't know it, or they did.
No, of course. Yeah. I sounded like a genius, but I wasn't. but that's where it begun for me, just in terms of going, wow, there is something out there, and it's powerful, and it's global.
Yeah.
And maybe if I worked hard at it. So that's actually when my fixation with coming to America started. Because at this point, my sister and my brother are going out to university in the UK.
Yeah.
And that's very common with, you know, West Africans. It's like, you know, and this is all post-colonial. So if you're like Francophone, you go to France, Belgium.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're Anglophone, you go to England. That's kind of what was happening. So my sister and brother went there for education. And I was like, I'm coming to America.
And this was, but your intent, you know, creatively was rap.
That's it.
When did you come to America? How old? Just college?
Yeah, I came for college. So 17.
So 17. So between like 12 and 17, you're just focusing
on music. Harnessing, learning what I could about it. And then I got accepted to Kent State University.
Wow, that's a heavy history.
Yes.
Were you hip to it?
I was hip. I didn't, you know. I need to go anywhere they'll take me.
Yeah. So you weren't hung up on it? You didn't get there and think, like, this is where that happened?
No. I was just like, my SAT scores were not great. Sure. Somebody will take me.
Yeah, so Ohio.
Ohio. I was like, okay. It's not New York. It's not L.A. But it'll do.
Yeah.
And it was great. I actually enjoyed my
all
time.
4 years?
All 4 years. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot.
Did you do music?
I did a lot of music. I opened for a lot of good bands that came. That was the great thing about not much was happening in the Cleveland.
Well, what was your setup?
It was just a DJ,
yeah,
and a mic,
yeah,
you know, and
right.
I was part of little sprawling groups. I did as much as I could, and
but
then,
straight up like New York style or
New York hip hop,
yeah,
you know,
right.
You know, faking it,
yeah,
again.
Yeah,
and then I graduate, but this is where it becomes like a crossroads.
With what degree?
Of all things,
yeah.
A marketing and advertising degree.
Who put you up to that?
Well, my parents wanted me to do architecture because, again, that's one of the respectable jobs.
That sounds interesting.
Well, it is, but yeah. That's what you think until you see those damn drawings.
Right.
And you go, this is boring.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like, the thing is, they go, you can draw.
Right.
So you should be an architect.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
like that's sketching yeah. and that's like lines.
Yeah, this is restricted.
Restricted.
It's engineering.
I couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
I did my one semester.
Yeah.
I bounced to like fashion merchandising. Couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Bounced to interior design. Couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
And then I stumble into a marketing class.
Right.
And I go, this is it. This is it. Yeah. I get it. It was intuitive.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm always going to be selling something.
Right.
So I might as well understand what that is.
Yeah.
And I love it.
So it's practical.
It's practical.
You could do your creative thing, and this is something I can use.
Use.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, graduating with that degree, literally not even taking off my graduation gown. That's how much I wanted to get out of Kent.
Yeah.
I jumped in my car. It was a van. It was a little blue Chevy.
Right.
With a bad brake. I remember that because every time I'll park it, it'll just like skid off a little bit.
Yeah.
It's a terrible car.
Yeah.
But I drove all the way.
You got to have a terrible car
you
when
got
you graduate college.
You had to. And I drove all the way to New York.
Yeah.
Guess what? They stole my car.
Good. Welcome to New York.
Literally the next day.
Yeah.
I walked around all of the way I thought I'd parked my car, which is Flushing, Queens.
Uh-huh.
The car was gone.
Yeah.
I went around chop shops,
uh-huh.
hoping to find something left of my car.
No.
Nothing. Uh-huh. Gone.
Lucky.
Vanished.
Learned how to use the subway.
Yes. So anyway, the one thing, though, that I was smart enough to carry upstairs in my new apartment, just three floors up, no elevator, was a box of my CDs that I had printed in college.
Of your music.
Of my music.
Yeah.
So now I go, all right. It's all I got, and I'm not about to go get a job right now.
Right, yeah.
So I'm going to sell these CDs in New York.
Yeah. How?
So I go, this is nuts. I go, where is like a big traffic area?
Yeah.
They tell me it's Union Square.
Sure.
Okay.
I remember those hip-hop guys selling those CDs.
Of course. I may have approached you and go, hey, yeah, you listen to hip-hop?
Yeah.
But here's the wild thing. So there was a Virgin Megastore, remember, right around that corner?
Oh,
right?
yeah, sure.
Before the Whole Foods showed up.
Yeah.
And I used to set up outside there until those guys were like, this guy's cutting into our business.
It was like down on Broadway, right?
Yeah, it was on Broadway.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful spot. So they used to kick me away from there. So then I moved a little further to actually the 14th subway station,
yeah.
The QRN.
Yeah.
I walk into the Virgin,
yeah.
And I see a long line of people waiting to hear whoever's album was out.
Right.
And I go, that's how you do it.
Right.
You don't approach people and ask them. You just have a setup.
Yeah.
And then they'll line up.
There's that marketing education. Yeah.
So I set up outside. Now I'm in front of like whatever that Whole Foods is.
Yeah.
And now I build me a little booth with a pair of headphones.
Yeah.
And I shit you not.
Just like a Virgin listening station.
I shit you not. People will line the fuck up.
Really?
And this is, you know, this is New York, man.
Yeah.
Nobody ever stops for nothing.
Yeah.
And that's when I learned, man, you can't chase them.
Yeah.
You got to attract them.
Sure.
You know? And that was a huge education. But the other thing my hustling in New York helped me do was watch movies. I mean, I've always been obsessed with the medium. But now, I was near the IFC. I was near the Film Forum.
Yep.
There was an AMC not far in a Regal.
And then that one right down on, what is it, 13th or whatever.
13th, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
So literally, whatever I made
yeah.
selling CDs, I'll go to the movies.
Yeah.
And I saw everything.
Yeah.
Old Prince, new Prince. That's actually where I got put onto I Am Cuba, Soy Cuba, which became like, you know, my kindred. And actually, it's how Dan Lawston and I bonded day one. It's like both our favorite movies.
Yeah.
I think I saw it at the Film Forum many
years. Who's Dan Lawston?
Dan Lawston's my DP.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. So that it goes that far back. It
goes that far back. Yeah. Right. So I would literally spend everything I made selling CDs and have to hop the turnstile. I mean, it was before, you know,
are you making
cameras?
Yeah, are you making new music?
Now?
At that time.
Oh, at that time, yeah. Yeah.
I'm making new music. Because you got this thing going.
So. Yes. And again, so I'm spending time in the movie theaters watching now. Now I'm building a film education.
Right.
So I always wanted to go to film school.
Right.
But just couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just
go watch movies. Movies.
That's it.
And then you get a good DP and how do we do this?
How do we do that? Exactly. You figured it out. So that really became it for me until, you know, and while this is happening, my music is also doing well, right? So now I'm breaking in Europe.
Really? Yeah. How'd that happen?
I got an opportunity to perform at a festival called Transmusicale de Rennes in France.
And you went?
I went, and I took a band of ragtag New Yorkers who ended up being some of my best friends now.
Horn section. See, that? When did you make that shift? Because like it starts to make sense to me that, you know, whatever the vision was or the agenda was, and I don't know where you came up with the name The Ambassador. But it seemed like, and I'm no hip-hop wizard at all, I don't go too deep with it, but it seems that there was a real intention to integrate West African sensibility into, American hip-hop.
Absolutely.
Because I don't know a lot, but it's very specific, you know, the music you come from.
Yes.
And it's in your records.
Yes.
I mean, I listened to Native Son.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's a good one because that's when I really figured out that hip-hop is just simple culture.
Yeah.
And if you understand how these samples work, okay, so you can either take Mingus, Miles.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Or you could take King Sonny Ade or Fela Kuti.
Yeah.
You know, all you got to do is add some edgy drums.
Yeah.
Often it's still always coming from James Brown and his cohorts, funky drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And then before you know it, you've got a thing. You've got an edge. And so Native Son was it. I mean, that was also when I went, oh, this can extend to not just music. It's a concept.
Yeah.
Cinema is sample culture too.
Right.
Right? We're always just picking things mix and matching.
Yeah.
And I go, wait, I can, those grandmother stories I got.
And then you used one of the songs from Native Son in one of the movies, Free Your Mind.
Which
movie is that in?
That is in Free Your Mind is in Burial of Kojo.
Yeah.
It's in Burial of Kojo.
So that was happening simultaneously.
Exactly. Mm. So now I'm going, oh, wait, this concept might work.
Yeah.
You know, it's all like finding this edge that like is Western culture and then figuring out the source, which for me is Ghanaian culture, visually and sonically. So now it just became the melding of the world.
Right. So sonically, it's an integration, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, where you come from, how do you say it, Ghanaian?
I'm Ghanaian.
Ghanaian culture infused into American hip hop.
Yes.
And then so your lyrics become, there's still sort of, the rhythm and the poetry is pretty much rap.
Yes.
But the storytelling capacity of rap is not going to get you to your grandmother.
No. Right. That's it.
Right.
By the way, no one's ever put it that way.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Yeah, that's brilliant.
And that's where you get the Burial of Kojo, ultimately.
That's where I get the Burial of Kojo.
Because the limitations of the music are, it's not that music is limited, but in terms of the limitations of the poetry that you can achieve through storytelling, and being it specifically a Ghanaian vision, you had to go to film.
I had to go to film. Right. It was the only way to fully maximize. Because my grandmother's stories were also, music, but they were visual. Mm-hmm. I really remember the visuals more than I do remember the music. We clapped and we sang, and she taught us little songs to go with the stories, but it wasn't enough. But then once I figured out the camera could capture that.
Right. And that, and also without explaining much, other than having the little girl talk about this world in between life and death, that imaginary world or not, the mystical world.
Yeah.
So then, you know, you can just leave that there.
Yes.
And then it's up to you watching it.
Yes. And I think that is also another thing that is very peculiar about African storytelling.
Mm.
It's very, the audience member is an active participant, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, it's always like there's always room for you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And it doesn't get explained.
That's
fully,
right.
You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, the blind guy comes with a bird.
Yes. What's that mean? now you've got to go, damn it. What's he trying to say? Oh, you know what? I think I know what he's trying to say.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. And it's how I feel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's how I feel. And I think that more and more there is, the more I've done the work,
yeah.
You know, and the more I've like just enjoyed being free on that level.
And letting it sit. Because the thing is, if something is carried down generationally, then who are you to explain it?
That's it.
So it must, even if you don't know how far back it goes, the symbols are what they are.
Yes.
So, you know, go with it.
Yes.
Go with whatever, God or whatever.
Exactly. And, you know, that's the beauty. And again, by the time I get to the color purple, I've done enough of that experimenting to go, because that's what Diasporadical Trilogia was. That was my first foray into, can I understand? And you broke it down so well. It's these movements, in these sonic movements, which now I have to match visually, right? So I go, okay, I think I get what this is trying to be. And then I go in long form and I do Burial of Kojo, and it explains itself a little bit more. Then I'm thrown into the deep end with Black is King, because now I'm like, oh boy, where am I? I got
it. It's a deep end, but it's also an unlimited possibility.
Yes.
Because, you know, you're working with Beyonce, and you're doing, you know, this sort of visual version of a concept record.
Yes.
And you know, it's all going to be, the music is the music.
Yes.
So you can sort of, you know, do whatever you want, and she's got the bread and the costumes.
Yes, and lots of costumes.
And you got a choreographer that I imagine she brought in.
Yep.
So, like, because there's a couple of beats in that, in The Black is King, where, like, that canoe shot where she's just, like, literally a vagina.
Yeah.
It's like there's this aerial shot, and I'm like, that's a floating vagina.
Yes. But, I mean, you got to remember, I mean, B
what
is—
about that, what about that snake one where they're all wearing that one outfit
on the
crate?
Yeah, with the snake. Oh, yeah, it's incredible.
What the fuck is that?
Yeah. But here's the beauty.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you said. It's provocative.
Yeah.
And that's what matters. And it got me thinking. I still watch that movie and ask myself, what does it all mean? You know what I mean? Like, I'm still trying to, and I think that's great art. I mean, it's like a, you know, it's like looking at a Basquiat painting.
Right.
Right? It's exactly, and I'm so glad you mentioned Basquiat earlier, because I've been to the gallery and museums to see the same Basquiat picture a few times.
Sure. That's why.
And every time, I'm like, what's this guy trying to say? Oh, I get that little part
there.
Sure,
but he reveals yourself to yourself.
That's it. And I think the more with age, with understanding, with growth, you see things, and I think that's good art. Good art is living.
I agree with you that, you know, that the genius of good art is that it grows with you.
That's it.
You know, no matter how many times you visit it,
that's it. You
will take something different away from it. Do you know what Kojo means?
I think I understand it more now.
Well, I mean, because like it seems that, you know, with Native Son, the short.
Yes.
And also with Kojo. And this is a journey fueled by grief.
Yes.
So, you know, that's real sort of, you know, childhood, you know, loss.
Yes.
And uncertainty.
Yes.
And so that journey in both of them, the one is the little girl, and that's different.
Yes.
But the kid's journey, the boy's journey in Native Son is more sort of, I can see that through to Black is King, where, you know, you are left with these choices and what life means. But with Kojo, Like, that was really kind of an amazing bit of a storytelling that left a lot of open space.
Yes.
Because, you know, you have the ocean. There's an isolating feeling. Yeah. There's a village feeling versus a city feeling. Yeah. But there's also, as it becomes revealed, the question of, you know, the shame.
Yes. Guilt.
Yeah.
Guilt. And I think, you know, I think it's also like, I also have always explored the complexity of the headspace.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it's another thing that's very underexplored in cinema, I think. I mean, just
you mean
this,
visualizing the headspace.
Visualizing.
Not just sitting there looking at someone thinking.
No, right. Exactly. Like, what are they thinking, right? Yeah. And I think that Kojo, there's a sense of grief, guilt that this man's wrestling with. And there's a story that's very clear, present, and linear. You know, a guy who's caused pain and havoc and has to deal with the consequences of that. And
right, but you know, it's sort of, you don't know that right up front.
No.
And then, like, the turn at the end of the second act, which is the, you know, the friend going, like, the uncle hasn't been around, he's been gone for 7 years.
Yeah.
And so that all is pulled out from under you. And then you're like, whose imagination was it and why? And the kid's operating on some supernatural level.
Yes.
So, you know, she saw the uncle.
Yes.
Because she was sharing the father's vision because she got the bird from the blind guy.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of it all, right? It's like, and I've really enjoyed making art that does exactly that, grows with you as you evolve as a human. But the beauty is, then I get this massive opportunity.
Well, that's the thing, like, you know, getting, you know, moving up to the color purple is that after you sort of work with Beyonce, it's sort of like the one thing out of all of it you got to be comfortable with is shooting people dancing.
Yes, like, absolutely.
But the idea, so what were, and I'm sure you've told this story before, because watching The Color Purple, you know, it does deal with all your themes, and you get a little Africa in there towards the end.
I do, and I milk that. I do.
That's your wheelhouse.
Yes.
Yeah. But what were the challenges, you know, well, from the beginning, you know, having, like, were you surprised that you got a shot at this?
I was. I mean, I'd never made a studio picture.
So who gets you that, Beyonce?
No. Blackest King wasn't out yet.
Huh.
It was rumored to be out. There was a trailer out, but it wasn't out.
Right.
My agent called me.
Yeah.
And was like, hey, you know, they're remaking The Color Purple. They've seen a few directors already, and somehow your name came up, and I want you to take a meeting. And I was just like, come on. They've seen a couple people. That's just telling me someone's already hired, and I'm just going to waste my time. You know,
or they're using you for leverage.
For leverage, yeah. You know. So, you know, I was quite skeptical at first. And then I think what I'm also the kind that's also like, what's the worst? I'll learn something.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to talk to a few big shots.
Why not? In Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know? In Hollywood. No, but you know, a part that I've missed that I think is important to this conversation.
Yeah.
In 2015, when I was like, music had kind of plateaued.
Right.
I played all the concerts I could. I hadn't scored a hit.
Right.
So there was no way I could imagine I was going to keep going.
Without getting sad.
Without exam. Sad. Very sad.
Yeah.
I got a call from my mom.
Yeah.
And she goes, are you thinking of making a movie?
Yeah.
And I go, you know, I'd like to.
This is before Kojo?
Before Kojo. She goes, are you thinking of making a movie? Because I had a vision.
Yeah.
And I saw Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is your mom a one that has visions?
Oh, here and there, but like not this level,
right?
But I was like, okay, you saw Hollywood?
Yeah.
I go, okay,
yeah.
So she goes, yeah, if you plan to make a movie, you should do it soon.
Yeah,
I kid you not, man. That summer, I packed all my crap and I moved back to that house, the same house where I learned to
sketch. Was it still under construction?
No, it's been done now. Been done for a while.
So your corner was gone?
The corner's gone, but there's a room because everybody's left now. Okay, so I'm in a real room.
Is your grandmother still around?
No, she passed away, sadly, a while back. While we were kids, actually, still.
Oh, okay. Know? Well, laid the imprint, though.
Yeah.
All right, huge. So you go back.
So I go back, and that room is where I write The Burial of Kojo.
Where'd that come from?
Well, it came from it came from, like, I grew up around people that I knew were dealing with, you know, just deep guilt, deep, you know.
Over one thing or the other?
One thing or the other, you know, remorse, you know, just.
And that struck you how?
It struck me as, like, how do people, you know, how do people who've dealt with trauma move on from that trauma? Or how don't they move on?
Right. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
My mom had dealt with some trauma.
Yeah.
Young. And so, you know, I'd always been in awe of her ability to just go, all right, fuck it.
Yeah.
Just keep going.
Right.
You know, and.
Not be consumed by it.
You know what I mean? So anyway, I'd kind of myself gone, it's something that struck me. And because, you know, Ghana also doesn't, you know, unfortunately have the infrastructures around mental health.
Well, neither does this country
for whatever reason. Well, yeah.
But you were suffering with some trauma yourself.
Not me myself, but I was witnessing a lot of people who had been doing it. My mom herself and their friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're the kid who's around, right? And you hear adults talking. You know, wow, these people survived some shit.
Yeah.
You know, my mom was thrown in jail during the coup d'etat.
Right.
You know what I mean? And she survived that, came out of jail. So these things were hard on them. But again, there's no, you know, there are no certified therapist to go talk to.
Sure.
So they talk to the guy who comes over to mend clothes from neighborhood to neighborhood.
Or
they
to
talk
each other.
To each other, the friends that come. Yeah. And they send you to go buy some beer so they can drink beer and talk about their problems. And you hide around the room and eavesdrop on some of this shit. And you go, damn, they've survived.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's always been something that struck me because there's no outlet for it. No real outlet. And so that's kind of where it came from, was just visualizing what it would be like if somebody has fucked up royally.
But also there's no saying that even with infrastructure or help that they're going to unfuck themselves.
That's a fact. That's a fact.
So, you know, this guy is suffering alone.
Yes.
You know, other than his, you know, mystical daughter knowing. But you don't know. You unfold that story very well. So your mother has this vision and you go back and do it.
So I go back and do it. And so anyway, now I get this call. You know, now things have happened quickly. Now, you got to remember, I shot Burial 17, 18. I'd done a few festivals. 19, Ava DuVernay had picked it up and put it on Netflix, which I'm
But you did the shorts earlier?
I did the shorts earlier, yeah. Before
Kojo,
yes. But those were like more of music video oriented, right?
Okay,
not narrative
right,
work.
You're in it.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, like because Native Son... It's sort of you selling
me
music.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was all like visual albums, you know? Yeah. So now I get this call that they're redoing The Color Purple. And I go, boy, all right. I should go take this meeting.
Right.
But before I do, I go, I should do what I've always done.
Yeah.
I should sketch.
Yeah.
You know, they said the script. I had read it. Had some things I liked. I was like, all right. So then I start sketching. But then I realize that I'm like, okay, because I remember the Steven Spielberg classic.
Sure.
It was brilliant. But before the Steven Spielberg classic, I was sucked into Alice Walker novel.
That book's something.
That was, I mean.
That's real poetry.
Incredible poetry.
Right?
And then I saw Steven's film and it sucked me in some more. But now here I am going, but what am I going to contribute? I mean, and then it's a Tony Award winning Broadway play. I'm like, well, this thing
is. Did you see it?
I didn't see it.
Mm.
But they had sent clips. So I was like, all right, well, it's done and done.
We had the music. Yeah.
It's done.
Right.
But then I go back to the Alice book.
Right.
Because I'm like, I have to have something to present. I can't just take a meeting.
Well, that's interesting.
I'm one of those that go, I know it's an interview. It's not a social call.
Yeah.
You know?
But so you knew, though, enough to know that if you're going to shoot your vision of it, you're not going to get Spielberg's out of your head because it's already in there.
There's
nothing you can do about it.
It's there.
The musical you can avoid, but you got the music.
Yes.
So you went back to the text.
Went back to the text. And I kid you not, first line, first page. She goes, "Dear God, blah, blah, I'm 14 years old.
Yeah.
Always been a good girl." I go, whoa, that's it.
Yeah.
Anyone who's writing letters to God on this scale.
Yeah.
It's got an imagination.
Right.
And that's one thing I know how to explore.
Right.
I'm an undisputed champion
right.
of exploring headspace.
Yeah.
In cinema. I go, I think I got something.
Yeah.
So then that's when I start sketching. I mean, I go in a frenzy. That's how the giant gramophone comes up, because I go, what
that was
I,
great. Yeah,
what
the dancing.
Can I do?
On, right,
can I,
right.
You know, so I keep pushing and pushing.
So that's her imagination. So
her imagination.
Was that the first one
that was
you
the
sketched?
First, that was the first thing I sketched. And crazy enough, that's how I got Fantasia to say yes to this film. She didn't want to do it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she was like, oh, she was like, Blitz, it was painful to do it on Broadway, you
yeah.
know? It was deep. She herself has dealt with deep trauma, didn't want to deal with it at all. I said, look, Fantasia, I'm going to give Seeley this massive, sprawling imagination. And here's the beauty. Often people who have dealt with trauma miscategorized as docile and passive.
Yeah.
Well, that's not what we're going to do.
Right.
We're going to give her this agency because we're going to be here.
And also, she doesn't have to do it every night, 5 nights a week.
A week.
You shoot a scene, you go sit down for 9 hours.
That's it. That's it. So, I mean, I think eventually she was sold, but I think she was most sold by that gramophone because she went, well, if he's going to push it that far.
Yeah. Why not?
Maybe something in here.
It's movies.
So that's how I went. I went to, first it was Scott Sanders, who was great. He told me I'll hear back. And I didn't know it was going to be.
Scott Sanders?
Scott Sanders is the producer of the Broadway show. So Scott was the first person I interfaced with. And then he was like.
That was your first interview?
First interview. And he was like, okay. And I was like, I'm done. You know, here I am throwing all these lofty ideas out. I'll never get this job. I go, you know, I'm on Zoom, so I just click off. And I go, well. That was nice. I came close.
Yeah.
Closer than any, by the way, closer than any Ghanaian ever has. You know, $100 million feature film.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
No one where I'm from has had this shot. So I was like, if I can just brag about this alone, that's good. I've come far.
Yeah.
Then comes a call. Yeah. Hey, Oprah would like to talk to you about your ideas.
Yeah.
Oh, the Oprah? Man, shit. I was like, I was in Ghana watching Oprah with my mom, by the way.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I go, well, I'll take the call.
Yeah.
I take it.
Uh-huh.
Blitz, I heard you've got this idea. Da, da, da. You know, so, ooh, get into pitch
You're
mode.
On Zoom with her?
I'm on Zoom. I mean, this is deep
with
COVID.
Oprah.
This is COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm like secretly trying to screenshot. Again, if this is the furthest I'm going to come, Mike, I'm not going to fuck it up.
You got the screenshot?
I'm going to have something.
Yeah.
It was. I can't admit to that on on a podcast.
Okay,
but I'll tell you what. I was like, you know what? Again, the furthest I'm going to come, incredible.
Right.
I've come far. I talked to Oprah about my ideas.
Yeah.
And she hangs up. We all go. And then it's like, by the way, this is happening. This is a Monday. This is a Monday.
Yeah.
On a Tuesday, I'm talking to Oprah. Now, my agent calls me. Hey, Oprah really likes your pitch. She wants you to talk to Steven about it.
Yeah.
Hey, oh, Steven. You know, Spielberg? I mean, that's Steven? I mean, a lot of Stevens now.
Sure.
You got to be sure which one they're talking about.
Yeah.
So I get on with Steven.
Yeah.
Same. He goes, Blitz, I heard you got an idea.
Yeah.
I would love to hear it.
Yeah.
Oh, I get in the pitch mode. I'm showing him sketch after sketch, and this is what I'm going to do. Boom, bam, bam. I do my whole. He goes, that's fantastic. He goes, I think you're the man for the job.
Yeah.
I go, what? And by the way, I'm after each of these Zooms, I have to go walk the block.
Sure.
Because it's literally, you got to remember, this is like when we were all confined.
Well, it's good. It was good because, you know, you got these meetings pretty quick because no one had anything to do.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. They were home.
Yeah.
Waiting to be scheduled on a Zoom.
Yeah.
So then the last thing now becomes, I think you should pitch it to the studio. Wow. So now I'm like, okay, again, guys, if this is the furthest.
But you got a couple big names in your court
already now.
Going to the studio.
And this is I'll give it a shout out to Toby Emmerich, because he goes, Blitz, if Steven, Oprah, and Scott say you're the man for the job, you're the man for the job.
Yeah, he's not gonna take any blame.
He goes, just tell me what you're gonna do.
Right.
I go, wow.
So you kinda got the job.
In a week.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, then the hard work begun, because now it's one thing to talk shit about how you're going to create an imagination. It's other things, how you're going to do it.
And, well, what was those sketches outside of the gramophone?
I mean, it was, you know, that, you know, 40-piece orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, I got to push that envelope.
Yeah.
It was the tree, all these people around the
tree. Sure, that last shot,
Last shot. It was all these things, you know, that I was like, it's a photograph. I was like, we're going to push into the photo and then, you know, get to the other side of it when it's getting taken. All of these, like.
That's some of the stuff in your painting, too, right?
Yeah. Picture in a picture.
Yeah.
You know, that's another way to collapse time for me. I love that concept.
Yeah.
You know, how do you get into the world, right?
Right, because you got the photograph, right? And then even in the paintings that you do, the few I saw that were available online, there's something interesting about the old photograph in the same place you come back into in the present.
Yeah.
So, empty.
Cyclical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Cyclical, the same work. And so, I mean, it was incredible. But once I started putting my team together, starting with Fatima Robinson, my choreographer, Fatima's a genius. And here's the thing: when I was
what's she done?
Oh, what hasn't she done? Yeah. Michael Jackson's Remember the Times.
Oh yeah,
jeez, all the Aaliyah stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
All that. I mean, she was
she's
a master.
Yeah,
and I knew that this is going to be a ballet of sorts.
Yeah,
the camera and the choreography.
Yeah.
So those were the first two, Fatima and Dan Lawston. Once I knew I had Dan, because I'd seen Dan's work, he'd done the big John Wick stuff, but he also done Shape of Water with Guillermo. He had done Nightmare Alley with Guillermo. So I knew the guy could do deep, intimate stuff.
Sure, and he also knew his way around whatever you wanted.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I brought him in, and then I brought Paul Astaberry, who had won the Oscar for the Shape of Water production design. And I love his work because it's very tactile. It's very real. It's immersive.
Yeah.
The way I like to make film. So I brought them together, and I brought Francine, who's my costumer. Francine had worked on Steven Spielberg's film.
Yeah. On The Color Purple?
In the 80s.
Yeah.
As an assistant costumer.
Oh.
So I brought her in as my lead now. She's amazing. I mean, those costumes.
Great.
Out of this world.
Yeah.
Once I got that click together, and I got the cast.
Yeah,
it wasn't easy advocating for Fantasia, advocating for Taraji, Danielle Brooks, Coleman Domingo.
You even got old Dion in there.
I got Dion.
Got a comic playing a heavy.
Oh my goodness. And how incredible
nailed
is that
it.
Guy?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
You know, and what I loved was the myriad of experience. I mean, I had a Lou Gossett Jr.
That's crazy. You know? Yeah, it was crazy.
Right?
I mean, was he even really actively working?
Probably not. But he came out. He was like, Blitz, I'm not missing this.
Yeah, he's great.
Oh, he was incredible. Yeah. He had all the funny lines.
How old is he in real life?
Jeez, that man's got to be 90
Yeah,
now.
Crazy.
You know?
Yeah.
He was phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I was lucky to land that cast because that cast became, you know, and I always say this, I cast aura.
Yeah.
You know, I don't cast, you know, people say, you know, cast is talent. Oh, no, I don't know. I don't know enough to know anything about that. I just know that when I see this person and that person together.
Feel a certain way.
Does the chemistry work?
Yeah.
And so it was so good to start to see these chemistries start to work. Coleman, his size, his aura, his vibe.
He played Mister?
Mister.
Yeah, that's a heavy role, man.
Incredible. And his arc, unfathomable.
Unfathomable because, like, you know, he's the charming devil.
Yeah.
Right? Classic. But then, like, somehow or another, you are capable of empathy.
Empathy.
Yeah.
And that was work. I mean, again, that's like going into the layers. But this is the beauty.
Because Glover played him heavy.
Heavy.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's all nuancing, right? I mean, that was the first thing Coleman and I talked about. We're going to make him human, fully human. That means he's going to go through all the entire arc. He'll be charming. He'll be funny.
Yeah.
He'll be goofy.
Yeah.
But he'll also be evil.
Yeah.
Because again, we're all capable of that entire arc.
But also you kind of grounded the evil with the father early, with Dion's character, relentlessly evil.
Yeah.
No depth.
Yes. Yes.
So that was, you know, and that was the foundation.
Yes.
Right.
So you had somewhere to go. And I think one of my most favorite shots is at that Easter table when everybody flees and we adjust, the camera just lingers.
Yeah.
And you see Mister at one side and old Mister at the other side. And,
right.
And you just sit. And what you're seeing is generational trauma.
Yeah.
What we're seeing is the understanding on how this man became who he is. We also put a banjo in his hand, which humanizes him.
Sure.
Right? And if you notice, he was the only one without a song. And he was the only one always trying to find a song. It was plucking away.
Oh, from the beginning.
From the beginning.
Never.
He never landed on his song. He just was always just trying. Everybody else belted out.
Right.
He was always just plucking at it.
Right.
And I think that was the beauty for having a master like Coleman.
Yeah.
Right? It's like someone who could play that arc. But also, I mean, Shug Avery.
Yeah.
You have a veteran like Taraji.
Yeah.
Who, when I met, I had to convince her. I was like, look, you've got it. You can do it all.
Only convince her because she didn't know if she was right for it.
Yeah. And it was all about the singing.
I've interviewed her. She's crazy. She's like the best.
The best.
Yeah.
And I said, Taraji, just surrender to this thing. You got it.
Yeah.
And I mean, she comes up that barge, that red dress.
The best. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that was all worth it.
But it's interesting, like, you know, because I don't remember, like, I read the book a long time ago, and I kind of remember certain scenes in the film. I did not see the musical, but I didn't really realize that there are no white people in this movie, except for the bad ones.
Except for Miss Millie.
Right.
Who's amazing. I mean, we do have the postman. He's nice.
Right. But like, this is like, you know, that to keep it around, like, because you don't even feel the presence of it.
No. It's very insular.
And Miss Millie's got to carry the whole weight.
Yes.
Of Reconstruction and racism in her, like, seemingly decent shell.
Yes. Yes. I mean, which I think, for me, two things. One is I loved the fact that we could just stay in this community, you know, and just deal with this very domestic, but also global, right? Because what Shug does is Shug brings the outside world. I mean, Shug's the reason we go to the movie theater. She's the reason we go to the juke joint. The reason we go to Memphis. Like, all these things that just kind of, she gives us this outer world. And so we didn't need much else, right?
Yeah, but it was great because, like, there's no, what's almost always sort of played against it is that it's all being facilitated by white people.
Yeah.
So none of that.
Yeah.
You know, that conversation doesn't happen. So these people can exist in a type of community.
Yes.
That it may be in the shadow of that, but it is.
No.
It's not spoken.
No. Not at all. And I
was that a choice or was that the way it was?
It was a choice. I mean, you know what I mean. Again, all these things. It's like the white gaze. You know.
Right.
It's like The Color Purple is an insular text. Alice Walker wrote it, inspired by her ancestors. They were very insular. And the only reason to step outside of that community is what happens when these people who are in this community have to venture into a world that they're not in. And Dan and I were very specific. And Paul, the intimidation that we were going to create just by the visual landscape we were going to choose.
Right.
Like, when that car drives into where Miss Millie is, that gas station,
right.
We chose tall, but we hadn't seen anywhere like it before. And I start on a wide to establish that, guys, this thing is not good. We start to feel uncomfortable as an audience because we're like, I've never seen any of this before.
Yeah.
I've never seen. So it's clear that these people have moved away from their safety and their comfort.
Yeah.
So when the encounter with Miss Millie happens, it's like, well, shit.
That's what the white gaze gets you.
That's what it is, right?
And that particular device is something you've used in almost all your films.
Absolutely.
The journey. Away from the village.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And I find that also because, again, my family's from a village.
Yeah.
And I know the challenges we've suffered, you know, by being outside, by that migration, personally, communally.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing about the village is that everybody cares for the village.
Yeah.
In the city, each man and woman for themselves.
Right.
And that's why you go to villages, they're clean and organized. You come to the cities, they're filthy and disorganized. But the sad reality is that everybody thinks the city is where life is at.
Right.
Right? And so this constant, you know, urban influx, you know, it's kind of what starts to happen. And same thing happens with, you know, they're going to get ice cream in this nice white part of town.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Now here we are.
Right.
Right. And I think that ultimately for me as a filmmaker, you also realize you've been telling the same story over and over again.
Mm.
Right. They just different forms, different vibes, uh-huh. different colors, different shapes. But it's ultimately the same story. It's how do people deal internally with their traumas and challenges? And how does the physical migration from rural to urban affect the psyche and the community? That ultimately, I think every film, I mean, even Blackest King's the same.
Yeah.
This kid, you know, flees, goes to the city. Oh boy, here comes all the temptations. Now look at him. Now he has to find his way back. And for me, that journey, finding your way back, when Celie goes back.
Yeah, she goes back, but she's informed and she has self-ownership.
Yes. Yes, which is also, I mean, that was me coming to America. I mean, it's always, it's the same thing, right? It's like, oh boy, you know, I moved to New York because I wanted to be in it. And then you go, oh boy, once you get what you want, also you got to know when you have it.
Yeah.
So you go, okay, now it's time to get out.
But right, but self-realized and self-actualized to the point where when you have the final scene and Mr. is in those pants, that Celie... Fantasia plays that kind of beautifully.
Yes.
That, you know, you're as an audience member, you know this history. And in your mind, you're like, how do you ever forgive or accept or move on? But the village is powerful.
The village.
In the sense where she goes, all she says is, I can't believe you wore those pants.
Yes.
And then, you know, the empathy portal is open and people can change.
Yes. Yes. Mm. Which is I think, you know, radical forgiveness, man, and accountability. I mean, those are the two things that all this work is about.
But in that scene with at that table with the two generations of the monsters, you know, you're waiting for that scene.
Yeah.
Because I remember, like, I don't remember exactly the movie scene with Oprah.
Yeah.
But the way that she played Sophie.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Sophia.
The actress.
Danielle Brooks.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, like, that was crazy.
It's incredible.
The insanity of, like, her self-assuredness before she gets beaten.
Yes.
And then what happens to her. And I know that's in the movie, too, and it's in the book. But, you know, that's a hard moment to play. You know, and in the movie, Spielberg's movie, he really, you know, made Oprah's disfigured.
Yeah.
But.
I didn't do that.
No.
I didn't do that. Because the scars are in something.
That's right. Because she played that. Yeah. And that's like, that was some fucking acting.
It was incredible.
And that turn was great.
I mean, I've seen people go from that laugh to that cry. I mean, I've.
Oh, yeah.
Listen, I watch it all. Yeah. I've never seen that.
Yeah.
That is some mass. That's a masterclass, and I gotta say, that scene had to be the hardest scene to shoot. I mean, first of all, any dinner scene with eight people,
eating's the worst.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like you're asking for it, but I think
because everybody's thinking like, where was I in the bite?
Yes, it's exactly that. Yeah. Then we also had COVID strike four times.
Oh.
We were trying to do that scene, so you think about it. We always had to reset. Come back 3 days later, come back 4 days later when people had recovered from COVID.
Yeah.
So sometimes we have to shoot with stand-ins.
Yeah.
It's a miracle. When I watch that scene, I go, John Poe, my editor, is a genius. Because to assemble that out of that many different days, and also Dan Lawston's light as consistent.
Yeah.
Whoa. You know? But that was something we did a lot.
Not in the studio either?
We were on a lot.
Okay,
we were on stage.
Yeah,
a little
control over it.
Yeah, we definitely had control.
Because that's the turning point. That's the beginning of the third act, basically,
that's
right?
Massive. Yeah. Massive. It had to happen.
Yeah.
This where she breaks free. But again, I mean, I have to say, it's really the amalgam of talent. You know, like when you look at, I mean, a film is always that, right? It's like the ultimate team sport. You go, yeah, sure, great. You have a great defensive, you know, player. But if your strikers and your midfielders are no good, you know, you're going to struggle. And so it's like I was just lucky and really fortunate to have across the board some of the most incredible humans first, but just masters of craft.
And also, like, every one of them, even from watching the moderated conversation in New York at that premiere, you know, everybody on that production, you know, anyone in the arts who is black, that story is part of them.
Yeah, facts. That's a fact.
So, you know, the honor and also the intimidation to rise to the occasion to do justice to that story.
Yeah.
So that, you know, is in of itself a challenge, but because, you know, there is that commonality.
Yes.
Of wanting to get to the core of that thing.
Yes. I mean, it was, I'll tell you what, man. I had to just say to myself, we're not remaking The Color Purple. I mean, first of all, you cannot compete with nostalgia.
Right.
I mean, because people aren't talking about the movie.
Right.
They're talking about their grandmother who passed away, who that was her favorite movie that they used to watch every Sunday.
Oh, that premiere dude, like, you had the two casts from the musical, and two of the, you know, one was in it, Fantasia, and Millie had watched
that?
It.
You saw that?
I saw it all.
You saw that?
I saw it all.
So, again, you go, you have to decide that you are making an original film based on familiar characters, based on a familiar story. You don't watch Steven's film. I didn't. The minute I got the job, I said, it's somewhere deep in the crevices in my heart.
Yeah.
Great. That's where it stays.
Yeah.
What the thing I did read a lot, though, was Alice's book.
Well,
because
of course.
That's abstract, and I could with between the poetry, I could find myself in it.
Right.
But ultimately, it was really about choosing an edge and deciding that we're going to make an original film.
Right.
Now, it was going to encapsulate a few things. One, visually, we had to set ourselves apart.
Yeah.
And this is where Dan Lawson and I talked a bunch. We first decided, okay, first of all, we cannot shoot a period film the way we're used to seeing them, which is, you know, seep your tone and fade.
No.
You know, we can't do that. One, I think it's a false equivalent in that people use photographs that have survived, I don't know, 100 years as the references, which is deceptive because the reality is that these people lived in color. We had to push into the photographs.
Right.
And it was even more vibrant if you think about it.
Sure.
You know, there wasn't ACs, there weren't
the
kinds of lights that existed were warm and broad day and southern light. So things were vivid. So Dan and I decided very early that we were going to lean into, like, forget about how we think about period films. We're going to lean into what it really was to
make
be
it now.
There. Make it now. So
yeah.
That was one. The second thing was musically, right? How are we going to make sure that not only are we, and this is where now I can go back to all those years of making music.
Yeah.
Because one thing I know, playing, I don't know, I've lost count, hundreds if not thousands of shows over my entire musical career.
The trying.
Yes, the trying. One thing I learned is that music doesn't come out the sky.
Yeah.
Right? And certainly black music does not come out the sky. I mean, if you go from the spirituals that became gospel that becomes blues that become jazz and births everything else, the music always has a source.
Yeah.
You know, is it, you know, does the drummer start it off?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Does the bassist, you know, doom doom, like it always has
the voice.
The voice. You know, does the voice just lead? You know, what is it?
It's all in there.
So that's what we leaned into, was always going, what's diegetic that can kick this off? Because I watched almost every musical in existence. I mean, I was like, I got to tell you, that's hard.
In preparation.
I mean, so many of them are not good. Some great ones. And the ones that were great, the reason I think they were great was that they always had a source.
Yeah.
An American in Paris. Oh, boy. Yeah. Gene Kelly, we're into music. And I was like, those are the ones, that's the kind of musical I want to make.
Yeah.
And so if you, from the opening shot, the horse's hoofs
that
build a cadence.
That's right.
Little banjo.
Yeah.
Little patty cake.
Yeah.
Okay, now here comes the music. Guys building the house.
Yeah.
Or putting up posters.
Yeah.
Oh, hammers. Okay, we can turn that into, so that's how we went into making.
And that's this. That's essentially cinematic. You're not doing that on stage.
No, you're not.
Right.
Exactly.
Because you can just, they're there.
They're there.
It's a visceral experience.
Exactly.
So how do you bring them into the visceral experience visually?
Visually. That's what it became about. Mm. And I think those were the things fundamentally that Dan and I and the whole gang, like Fatima, Robbins, we were always going, how can we make this lived in? When I split up the music into three parts, gospel, blues, and jazz, I went out, I found Ricky Dillard, who's a gospel aficionado.
Yeah.
I found Cab Mo.
Blues guy.
I brought in Christian McBride on jazz.
Yeah.
And I got these three guys together. And I said, guys, this music we've gotten from Broadway.
Right.
It's great for Broadway.
Right.
But we've got to make it lived in.
Yeah.
People have to feel like this thing is coming out of the souls of these people.
Yeah, yeah.
How are you going to do that? And I mean, having those masters, phenomenal. And that's how we arrive here.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, you had complete faith in the ensemble's emotional capacity to do the humanity of the parts. So then you can like go, all right, that's set.
That's it.
So now we do this.
Yes.
Then how do you approach the dance?
Yes.
Same way?
Same way. Fatima and I sat through it and we said, listen, because I had this whole concept around, first of all, scale.
Yeah.
We were going to make the biggest version of this property as it's ever existed.
Yeah.
Proximity to audience today. Like, you can't make a musical set 100 years ago and nobody have a way in. You have to be proximate to audience.
But you didn't cheat.
No. No. Because you know what it is? Because you're looking at the continuum. And what you're saying is, what has survived?
Right.
Because, you know, African-American life, history, and culture is an ongoing thing.
Yeah.
You know, the dances these kids do today, yeah, that they think they're inventing, no, dude. Yeah. It's this. It goes back.
Sure.
So the thing is, you know, some of the fashion style. I mean, Mr.'s hat. I remember I went on in the truck, and I said, guys, we only want stuff that I think is cool to wear today. If I'm going to steal something off this truck and go rock tonight,
yeah,
to a party,
right,
that's what we're using.
Yeah.
So that's what I want you to find me. I don't want you to find me, yeah, it's period correct, great. Everything's going to be period correct, but find what's cool. Yeah. Find what's cool.
But you didn't do that dumb trick with dialogue or rhythm or anything else where you sort of all of a sudden you're out of it because like they wouldn't say that.
No, exactly. No, we were very on it.
Yeah.
It was, but the thing, and then authenticity was my last pillar.
Yeah.
SPA, scale, proximity, and authenticity. Yeah. Authenticity was always going to keep us in check. So that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah.
So sometimes I go, it was always about passing it between Francine on costumes, Dan on cinematography,
yeah,
Paul, and Fatima.
Yeah.
And then so one person takes proximity. So maybe Fatima might add a dance move that feels current.
Right? Yeah.
Good for you. But then in that, Francine's got to make sure we're authentic.
Right.
And Dan's got to make sure we got scale.
Yeah.
Or Paul's got to make sure. So it was literally, in every meeting we'll have, I'll go, who's taking scale?
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Who's taking proximity?
Yeah.
And who's taking authenticity?
Yeah.
Because every shot has to have all three.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
It's the only way you can make something that resonates today, but feels authentic and grounded.
Yeah.
And yet still feels like the biggest thing you're watching.
Right.
Because again, the other thing is, remember, Celie's life is a life on a farm, ultimately.
Yeah.
It's a very, you know, it's a small world, ultimately. How do you make that world expansive and epic? Well, that comes from how do you deal with her headspace? How do you deal with environments?
Her need to escape.
Her need to escape. That's it. Escapism, right? And I found that was the great mix of having all these people working in harmony, trying to find this end goal.
Yeah. And it came out beautiful.
Thank you.
A lot of crying.
Oof.
And, you know, the audience was engaged. How you find it with every screening?
It's
same
magical. Mm. Listen, it's even crazy. I was just in Brazil. And I, you know, you go to Brazil, you go, well, it's not in English. I mean, it's not in Portuguese.
Right.
Okay. You know, some subtitles, but they're probably going to miss most of the jokes.
They'll
probably miss a lot of it. Dude, blew my mind.
They got it.
Laughed at everything, cried at everything, gasped.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And then you go, boy, this thing's working.
Yeah.
And every room I've been in, I hear it all.
Yeah.
And what if I couldn't have imagined it. But somehow too, I was like, it's the only version to make.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, it's not like you couldn't have imagined it, but you did.
Yeah. Kinda, right? It's crazy.
No, not only did you imagine it, you had a plan and you put the infrastructure in place with the people that you could trust who were brilliant, and you manifested the plan.
That's it. Wow.
Good job.
Thank you. I'm still in wonderment.
Yeah.
Honestly.
It is.
I mean, and every time I get to talk about it with my cast, the emotion. And I'm also realizing what this means to them.
Yeah.
You know, Fantasia being written off, done.
Yeah.
Oh, American Idol, she'll never amount to anything.
Yeah.
And watching her have a moment right now.
Oh, she was so good. I mean, the acting and the goodness. That's the other trick is that you're making, you know, she you know, she knew how to sing real.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was in place.
Yes.
Same with Millie.
Yes. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. Really, really fortunate.
Great job, man. And it's good talking to you.
Oh, it's amazing. Thank you for having me,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, buddy. Good
appreciate
to talk
it.
To you.
Appreciate it.
I love that guy. Man, we had it going. Got on a nice groove there. The Color Purple opens in theaters on Monday, December 25th. Hang out for a minute, folks.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.
Folks, now it's time to catch up on Full Marin episodes if you're a new subscriber or if you haven't signed up yet. Go check out our talk about some of the problematic episodes from our past. That's Archive Deep Dive from August 15th.
I just ordered a copy of Crimes and Misdemeanors by Woody Allen. And you know, I know what Woody Allen did and I know where he stands in the world, but I don't know that I can separate that movie being a masterpiece, you know, from who he is.
Yeah.
But it's still like, it's still part of me.
That's right.
And my belief in that piece of work.
Yes.
And I think this speaks to the ideas that we're talking about here about leaving things up that you can't, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's right or left reasons or ethics or whatnot, erasing history generally is not a great idea.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. But that's the thing. It's like, I'm never, obviously never going to go erase this Louis episode, but if I went unannounced and reposted it today, so it's the first thing that shows up in your podcast feed tomorrow, yeah, it would be loaded.
Right.
Like that's a statement in and of itself to just put that episode back out there without context.
But is it though, if you just date it? Because no matter
but
what
that's you, what it would need. It would need more than just to have the date on it.
Yeah.
It would have to have like, we're putting this up there because we still consider it the best episode.
Right. But also, like, no matter what you do, you know, people are going to have their feelings, perceptions, and beliefs about, you know, that person, and they're going to bring that to the episode, and that's just going to be the way it's going to be.
We have two bonus episodes every week, so sign up by going to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And speaking of the Full Marin, next week we have a Mark on Movies Christmas Day special. We'll have a collection of some of the movie talk we've done in the past year. Then on Thursday, my old friend Matt B. Davis, who's a comedian who I knew many years ago, we're both sober guys. He went into the obstacle race game and he made a documentary about that. But we also had some personal stuff we had to deal with. This is a very a kind of engaged episode between a couple of guys that took different paths, but were once on the same one, kind of getting some shit straight. Exciting. Yeah, Matt B. Davis on Thursday. Okay, here's some pretty simple guitar that just made me feel nice.
lives. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.